Earth. The story that comes along with a scientific theory influences the experiments that scientists choose to perform, the way new evidence is evaluated, and ultimately guides the search for new theories as well. In his 1952 papers outlining his new interpretation, Bohm made exactly this point. The purpose of a theory is not only to correlate the results of observations that we already know how to make, he wrote in the conclusion to his second paper, but also to suggest the need for new kinds of observations and to predict their results. Bohm laid part of the blame for the Copenhagen interpretation at the feet of logical positivism, the philosophy of science inspired by Mach, which we first encountered in Chapter 3. The Copenhagen interpretation, in Bohm's view, was guided to a considerable extent by the idea that objects that can't be seen aren't real, an idea Bohm ascribed to positivism. Yet, as Bohm pointed out, the history of scientific research is full of examples in which it was very fruitful indeed to assume that certain objects or elements might be real long before any procedures were known which would permit them to be observed directly. Bohm then gave the example of atoms, the existence of which Mach resisted to the end, despite the overwhelming evidence to support them, because they couldn't be seen. Bohm made this point again shortly after he arrived in Brazil, in a letter he wrote to his friend and fellow physicist Arthur Whiteman. Tentative concepts are needed, even before empirical evidence is available, to guide the choice and design of experiments, as well as to aid in their interpretation. Very often, the actual empirical evidence for a new idea comes from surprising quarters. Witness Brownian movement, the first evidence for existence of atoms discovered by a biologist. However, such evidence can be appreciated only by people who are alert to the possibilities. For this reason, I would argue in favor of the widest possible diffusion of knowledge of all the possibilities among physicists. At a time like this, physicists ought to know of all the possibilities, and to feel that while they do not know which of these are correct, they must be ready, if necessary, to abandon even what seemed most secure and beautiful in the old point of view, in favor of what may seem arbitrary and ugly in the new point of view, if this should help explain something. Yet as Bohm pointed out in his 1952 papers, positivism's reflection still remains in the philosophical point of view implicitly adopted by a large number of modern theoretical physicists. To positivistically inclined physicists, it wasn't just that there was no need for a new interpretation of quantum physics. According to them, there was no need for any interpretation whatsoever. Quantum physics perfectly correlated and predicted observations, and that's all a scientific theory needed to do on a strictly positivist account of science. Any ideas about what nature was actually like that came along with a theory were just extra baggage. This was the logic behind Bohr's rhetoric of inevitability, as the historian of science Mara Beller called it. Bohr and his followers said the Copenhagen interpretation was not just the correct way of understanding quantum physics. They said it was the only way to do it, the necessary and inevitable conclusion of the quantum revolution. Every feature of the Copenhagen interpretation, claimed Leon Rosenfeld, one of Bohr's closest colleagues, has been forced upon us as the only way to avoid the ambiguities which would essentially affect any attempt at an analysis in classical terms of typical quantum phenomena. Thus, according to Bohr's camp, the search for another interpretation wasn't just unnecessary. It was a waste of time. By the time Bohm's papers appeared, 7 years after the end of World War II and the changes it brought to the culture of physics, this view was prevalent among physicists. Bohm, of course, had put the lie to the rhetoric of inevitability by creating a live alternative to the Copenhagen interpretation. But recognition that Bohm had achieved anything at all with his theory was hard to come by. Bohm had anticipated that he might be ignored or disparaged, but when word reached him of his work's reception in Princeton, he was, understandably, slightly unhappy. As for the Princetitute, What those little farts think is of no consequence to me. I am convinced that I am on the right track. Bohm, in his Brazilian isolation, could vent his frustration only through letters to his friends. And those same letters were his only indication of what was happening in the wider world of physics. Weeks after arriving in October 1951, Bohm was summoned to the U.S. consulate in Sao Paulo. Once there, his passport was confiscated and stamped valid for return only to the United States. But Bohm was afraid of what would happen to him if he did return to his homeland. "The best possible interpretation is that they simply do not want me to leave Brazil," Bohm wrote to Einstein. "And the worst is that they are planning to carry me back because perhaps they are reopening this whole dirty business again." Bohm had hoped to travel to Europe to meet with other leading physicists there and defend his ideas. "It is really necessary for me to give talks, in Europe if possible, and perhaps even in U.S. if Europe is not possible, or else nobody will take the trouble to read my paper," he wrote to a friend. Without a passport, Bohm would have to mount his defense remotely. It didn't go well. Before his papers appeared in print, Bohm had sent drafts to several of the founding fathers of quantum physics, some of whom had written to Bohm just months earlier with praise for his textbook. De Broglie wrote back, pointing out that he had thought of similar ideas 25 years earlier, but Pauli and others had set him straight by raising important problems with the pilot wave theory. Pauli wrote back next, throwing those same problems at Bohm. But Bohm managed to handle them with style and aplomb, through his brilliant insight that measurement devices themselves must be incorporated in his quantum descriptions. Pauli, after a lengthy and heated exchange of letters over the next few months, finally conceded that Bohm's theory was consistent, though he still maintained that, since there was no way to test it against normal quantum physics, it remained a check that cannot be cashed. Ultimately, Pauli thought that Bohm's ideas were simply artificial metaphysics. Niels Bohr himself never wrote back to Bohm, but Bohm did receive a report from his friend, Art Whiteman, who was visiting Bohr's institute at the time. According to Whiteman, Bohr thought that Bohm's theory was very foolish and didn't say much else. Von Neumann, meanwhile, was less dismissive. He thought Bohm's ideas were consistent and even very elegant, but suspected that Bohm would have difficulties extending his theory to encompass the quantum phenomenon of spin, a suspicion that ultimately proved to be wrong. Von Neumann's suspicion was likely born of his own impossibility proof, demonstrating the necessity of the Copenhagen interpretation. Bohm knew that his own theory showed that something was wrong with that proof, or at least that it was a less powerful proof than commonly supposed by other physicists. Bohm discussed how his theory evaded von Neumann's proof toward the end of his second paper laying out his pilot wave theory. But his analysis of von Neumann's proof was somewhat unclear at best, and simply incorrect at worst. And without a clear and pithy explanation of what had gone wrong in von Neumann's proof, many physicists assumed the flaw was with Bohm's theory instead, that it simply couldn't be correct, because von Neumann had shown such theories were impossible. There were a few physicists who did come around to supporting Bohm's view, most notably Louis de Broglie, who took up his old interpretation and started a priority dispute with Bohm over the work. Bohm resisted acknowledging de Broglie's contributions at first. "If one man finds a diamond and then throws it away because he falsely concludes it is a valueless stone, and if this stone is later found by another man who recognizes its true value, would you not say that the stone belongs to the second man?" Nonetheless, the dispute was short-lived and resolved amicably. When Bohm wrote a book on his new interpretation several years later, de Broglie wrote a glowing introduction in which he described Bohm's work as elegant and suggestive. De Broglie's institute in Paris became one of the few places in the world where dissent against the Copenhagen interpretation was the norm. Bohm also hoped for support from Soviet physicists and other communists. His interpretation made quantum physics explicitly about stuff existing in the world rather than an abstract statement of what physicists can say about experimental outcomes. This lined up well with the emphasis on materialism and rejection of positivism that was a common thread in many strains of Marxist thought. Marx positivism, in particular, was a common Marxist punching bag. Even Lenin himself had condemned Marx. In Materialism and Imperio-Criticism, Lenin called Marx's philosophy reactionary and solipsist. There were some Soviet physicists who took up this sort of change against the Copenhagen interpretation, such as Dmitry Blokhinstev and Yakov Terletsky, whose work Bohm encountered after developing his own interpretation. Bohm's theory had also appeared during the height of Zhanovism, an ideological campaign by Stalin's USSR to stamp out any intellectual work that had even the faintest whiff of a conflict with the ideals of Soviet communism. Though there were certainly versions of the Copenhagen interpretation that could be compatible with Soviet state ideology, the aura of positivism that hung around the Copenhagen interpretation was enough to keep most Soviet physicists from defending Bohr's ideas publicly under Stalin's rule. This led to the age of banishment of complementarity in the USSR, according to historian of science Loren Graham. Some of Bohm's fellow Marxists did respond positively to his work. Several of de Broglie's students, most notably Jean-Pierre Vigier, found both Marxism and Pilot Waves appealing. Yet many Marxist physicists didn't back Bohm's ideas. While Blokhinstev and Terletsky were critical of Bohr's principle of complementarity and the other trappings of the Copenhagen interpretation, sometimes vocally so, they did not support Bohm's interpretation, instead pursuing their own alternatives to the quantum orthodoxy. Indeed, Bohm suspected that Zhdanovism may have simply kept most physicists behind the Iron Curtain from discussing questions of quantum interpretation at all. I ask myself the question, why in 25 years didn't someone in USSR find a materialist interpretation of quantum theory? It wasn't really very hard, he wrote to his friend Miriam Yevich. In USSR, there has been much criticism of quantum theory on ideological grounds, but it produced no results, because it may have scared people away from these problems rather than stimulate them. In any event, the policy of Zhdanovism died with Stalin in 1953, leading to the relative relaxing of ideological strictures in the Soviet Union under Khrushchev. This freed Russian physicists who had sat at Bohr's feet to be more vocal in their support of the Copenhagen interpretation. One of them, Vladimir Fock, campaigned for Bohr's ideas throughout the Soviet physics education system, referring to the Pilot Wave interpretation as the Bohm-Vigy illness. And Bohm conjectured that others were hesitant to criticize the Copenhagen interpretation, not only out of allegiance to Bohr, but also out of fear that they would appear to be doing so for ideological reasons. The USSR had already produced Lysenkoism, a bogus alternative to Darwinian evolution based on a proper Marxist understanding of biology. Soviet biology and agriculture took decades to recover from the damage done by Lysenko and his pseudo-scientific cronies. The last thing that good physicists in the USSR wanted was a similar fiasco in quantum physics. One Marxist in particular had it in for Bohm, Leon Rosenfeld, Bohr's right-hand man in Copenhagen. Rosenfeld's twinned devotions to complementarity and Marxism led Pauli to nickname him Square Root of Bohr times Trotsky. Rosenfeld took it upon himself to defend the one true quantum physics from Bohm. I certainly shall not enter into any controversy with you or anybody else on the subject of complementarity, he wrote to Bohm, for the simple reason that there is not the slightest controversial point about it. Rosenfeld spent much of his time participating in this non-existent controversy, devoting remarkable effort to preventing the spread of Bohm's ideas. Rosenfeld successfully prevented Bohm from publishing a paper in Nature. He also prevented a translation of a Russian paper, critical of complementarity, from appearing in Nature by convincing the translator to withdraw it. He even managed to prevent the publication of an English translation of a book by de Broglie on pilot waves. And when Bohm published his book on the pilot wave interpretation several years later, Rosenfeld wrote a scathing review, claiming Bohm had hopelessly misunderstood quantum physics. It is understandable that a pioneer advancing in unknown territory does not find the best path at the outset. It is less understandable that a tourist still becomes lost after that territory has been surveyed and mapped down to one part in 20,000. Rosenfeld's views were largely shared by the physics community, as one of his friends commented in a letter to him. "I was much amused by the onslaught on David Bohm. Half a dozen of the most eminent scientists have got their knife into him. Great honor for somebody so young." Those eminent scientists included not only Rosenfeld and Pauli, but also Werner Heisenberg, who dismissed Bohm's theory as a kind of ideological superstructure which has little to do with immediate physical reality, and Max Born, who said that Pauli slays Bohm not only philosophically, but physically as well. Yet there were private ideological divisions among Heisenberg, Born, Pauli, Rosenfeld, and the rest of the old guard. Rosenfeld thought Heisenberg was flirting with idealism, a devastating insult from a Marxist, while Pauli and Born thought Rosenfeld was too politically motivated in his science. But the founders of the Copenhagen interpretation closed ranks against Bohm despite their disagreements. And it wasn't just the old guard who found Bohm's ideas distasteful. Younger physicists, insofar as they paid attention to Bohm at all, were also dismissive of him. In particular, many were troubled by an unavoidable fact of Bohm's theory. It was non-local, allowing particles to influence each other instantaneously at long distances. A single particle, wandering the universe on its own without bumping into anything, is guided in its path by its own pilot wave, and is perfectly local. But introduce a second particle that interacts in any way with the first, and suddenly they are linked, entangled. And the pilot wave of one particle will change depending on the precise location of the other particle, no matter how distant it may be. This kind of spooky action at a distance also appeared in the Copenhagen interpretation. It was exactly what Einstein had argued against in the EPR paper. But many physicists were still unaware of the EPR argument, and most that were aware of it profoundly misunderstood it. To them, the manifest action at a distance in Bohm's theory was another strike against it when compared to Copenhagen. There was also the question of whether Bohm's ideas would actually lead to new research insights. In particular, because Bohm's theory involved faster-than-light connection between particles, it appeared difficult to extend Bohm's ideas to incorporate special relativity. Relativistic quantum theory, known as quantum field theory, or QFT, was already an active and productive area of research in the United States and Europe. QFT was originally pioneered by Dirac and was being led at the time by people like Feynman, Julian Schwinger, Shinichiro Tomonaga, and Freeman Dyson. QFT met with great success. Dirac had used it to predict the existence of antimatter, which won him a Nobel Prize. Others had used it to prove deep connections between seemingly unrelated quantum properties, and to explain the increasingly complex results in high-energy particle physics that were pouring in from the growing number of particle accelerators around the world. And non-relativistic quantum theory was also being used to great success in other areas, such as solid-state physics. According to Sam Schweber, Bohm was still highly regarded for his other work in physics, but nobody could see how to apply his new ideas about quantum theory to the wide variety of interesting problems at hand.
"So much was happening, both in solid-state physics and high-energy physics, that people weren't that much concerned with foundations," recalled Schweber.
Bohm's interpretation of quantum theory, he said, is not generative. It's very difficult to see how to do Bohmian quantum mechanics when you want to generalize it to quantum field theory. It lay on the side. Bohm's theory would have to account for the success of QFT and connect to other areas of already active research if it were to survive. But Bohm, stuck in Brazil, found progress slow.
I alone am supposed in a year or two to produce a scientific revolution comparable to that of Newton, Einstein, Schrödinger, and Dirac all rolled into one, he complained to a friend.
Bohm's exile also made it difficult for him to keep in touch with the latest developments in quantum physics. He dismissed his friend Richard Feynman's latest work in QFT, which would eventually garner Feynman a Nobel Prize, as long and dreary calculations on a theory that is known to be of no use.
Bohm's geographical and ideological isolation was taking a serious toll on his scientific work.
Even staunch opponents of the Copenhagen orthodoxy, like Erwin Schrödinger, didn't lend Bohm support. Schrödinger still had massive problems with the Copenhagen interpretation, even after a quarter century, and continued to fight it until his death.
The impudence with which you assert time and again that the Copenhagen interpretation is practically universally accepted, assert it without reservations, even before an audience of the laity, who are completely at your mercy, it's at the limit of the estimable, he wrote to Max Born in 1960. Have you no anxiety about the verdict of history?
Yet when Bohm wrote to Schrödinger about the pilot wave interpretation, he received only a reply from his secretary, who said that Schrödinger wasn't interested in his work.
Schrödinger does not deign to write me himself, but he deigned to let his secretary tell me that His Eminence feels that it is irrelevant that mechanical models can be found for the quantum theory, grumbled Bohm. Of course, His Eminence did not find it necessary to read my papers. In Portuguese, I would call Schrödinger um burro, and leave it for you to guess the translation.
Schrödinger was preoccupied with his own attempt to interpret quantum physics, a picture of the quantum world in which there was only a wave function with no particles at all. Particles guided by pilot waves were wholly uninteresting to him. Most disappointing of all, though, was Einstein's reaction to Bohm's work. Einstein was certainly sympathetic to Bohm's motivations. It was Einstein's advice that had given Bohm the courage to develop his ideas in the first place. But he was not at all pleased with the answer that Bohm had arrived at.
Have you noticed that Bohm believes, as de Broglie did, by the way, 25 years ago, that he is able to interpret the quantum theory in deterministic terms? Einstein wrote to his old friend Max Born. That way seems too cheap to me.
Einstein's letter didn't go on to explain what exactly was too cheap about Bohm's ideas. But the pilot wave interpretation did have a few features that were clearly unacceptable to Einstein. Objects could move in strange ways, or fail to move at all when it seemed like they should. Einstein pointed out that in Bohm's theory, a particle trapped in a box could be motionless, despite having an enormous amount of kinetic energy, energy of motion. This contradicted the principle that quantum physics should agree with classical physics for large objects. In reply, Bohm pointed out that in such a situation, if you opened the box, the walls of the box would interact with the particle, ensuring the previously motionless particle would go shooting out of the box at high speed, a high speed corresponding to the kinetic energy it had before the box was opened in the first place. Strange, certainly, but any theory would have to be strange to reproduce the counterintuitive results of quantum physics. To Einstein's credit, he arranged for Bohm's reply to his criticism to be published alongside his own views. Einstein was also unhappy with the idea of non-locality. He knew the Copenhagen interpretation was non-local, so this feature of Bohm's theory wasn't any worse than the usual view. But Einstein couldn't see any physical reason to give up locality. The EPR argument made it clear that quantum physics was either non-local or incomplete, and Einstein's money was on the latter. Writing to Born, he said that
When I consider the physical phenomena known to me, and especially those which are being so successfully encompassed by quantum mechanics, I still cannot find any fact anywhere which would make it appear likely that locality will have to be abandoned. Einstein also wanted to find other ways to describe what was going on at the quantum level altogether. The Copenhagen interpretation and Bohr insisted on the necessity of using classical concepts, along with classical descriptions of measuring apparatuses. Bohm's ideas broke with both, but not as thoroughly as Einstein had hoped for. Einstein wanted a new way of looking at nature, a theory underlying quantum physics that would reveal some previously unknown truth, rather than a new way of interpreting the existing quantum theory. Einstein hoped to find such a picture in a unified field theory, something that would unite his theory of general relativity with the deeper reality he was convinced lay underneath the mathematics of quantum physics. Writing of Einstein after his death, Born said that his ideas were more radical than Bohm's, but music of the future. History was repeating itself. Just as in Solvay, 25 years earlier, the defenders of the Copenhagen interpretation presented a united front despite their private disagreements, while the rebellion, unable to agree on a single position, fizzled out. After 2 years, Bohm was itching to leave Brazil. His theory was being alternately ignored or disparaged, and he couldn't travel to speak in its defense. He turned to Einstein for help. Despite his distaste for the pilot wave interpretation, Einstein was still generally supportive of Bohm. Now, Einstein pulled some strings to set Bohm free. He contacted Nathan Rosen, his former assistant and co-author of the EPR paper, and asked him whether he could hire Bohm at his new physics department in his new country, Israel. Bohm, as a talented physicist and Jewish political refugee, seemed like a natural fit for Israel. Einstein, as the most famous Jew in the world, had considerable pull there. Rosen arranged for a job for Bohm, but without a passport, Bohm was still trapped in Brazil. With his job offer in hand, Bohm attempted to get Israeli citizenship. When that failed, Einstein suggested getting Brazilian citizenship and traveling on that passport. Bohm's Brazilian contacts smoothed the wheels of government for him, and Bohm became a Brazilian citizen on December 20th, 1954. Several months later, Bohm finally left Brazil after nearly 4 years there. Bohm took well to life in Israel. He met a fellow immigrant, Sarah Wolfson, and they were soon married. He published a book on his version of quantum physics. He traveled to Europe to meet and work with other physicists. He even went to Bohr's Institute in Copenhagen a couple of times, though he worked solely on plasma physics there, and there is no record that he ever spoke with Niels Bohr about the pilot wave interpretation. Bohm also worked with a particularly talented student in Tel Aviv, Yakir Aharonov. Wishing to avoid tainting Aharonov with the scent of his own heresies, he made a pact with him at the outset of their collaboration. They would do all of their work in normal quantum physics, rather than Bohm's new version. Together they found a surprising new consequence of quantum physics that would be Bohm's best-known work in normal physics, the Aharonov-Bohm effect, an unusual feature of the behavior of electrons and other charged particles traveling near electromagnetic fields. Bohm, meanwhile, convinced himself that he had been wrong about the pilot wave interpretation. After writing his book on the subject, Bohm decided that he had been mistaken, and that his interpretation didn't work after all, though he still didn't think the orthodox Copenhagen view could be right either. He abandoned his interpretation for a variety of reasons. He couldn't see how to make it work with special relativity. He was discouraged by the lack of interest from the wider physics community, and he couldn't see a way forward with the ideas from his own theory. "Because I did not see clearly at the time how to proceed further," he said years later. "My interests began to turn in other directions." This change came at roughly the same time as another, related, major intellectual shift for Bohm.
in the wake of the brutal suppression of the Hungarian uprising in 1956, Bohm abandoned his Marxism. This change in philosophy altered Bohm's thinking about the nature of the quantum world, which further motivated him to abandon his old ideas. As Bohm searched for a new approach to quantum physics, he finally found some stability in his professional life. He left Israel in 1957, taking a temporary appointment at the University of Bristol in the UK. Several years later, he found a permanent position at Birkbeck College at the University of London, and eventually he was offered two permanent positions in the United States, one at the newly formed Brandeis University in Boston, and another several years later at the New Mexico Institute of Mining and Technology. But when he attempted to take these jobs, he faced a new problem. The U.S. government, upon learning of his Brazilian citizenship, had stripped him of his American citizenship. And with his ties to communism still fresh in the minds of the State Department officials, Bohm's application to regain his citizenship in his native land was not looked upon kindly. He could return and become an American again, they told him, if he publicly renounced communism. Although Bohm was no longer a Marxist of any stripe, he considered it unethical to publicly renounce his former political views simply as a means to some other practical end. "I feel it wrong to say it," criticized communism, "in order to regain American citizenship. For then I am saying something not mainly because I think it is true, but rather for some ulterior purpose. It's rather like writing a scientific article in order to impress one's superior so as to get a better job." Unwilling to compromise his integrity, Bohm remained at Birkbeck. Meanwhile, the pilot wave interpretation sank into obscurity as Bohm searched for a new way to understand the quantum world. But back at Princeton, where all his troubles began, a new alternative had already been found. 6. It came from another world. Albert Einstein gave the last lecture of his life in Princeton, New Jersey, on April 14, 1954. It was a guest lecture in John Wheeler's graduate seminar on relativity, but the subject inevitably turned to the role of the observer in quantum physics. "On quantum theory, I use up more brain grease than on relativity," Einstein once told his friend Otto Stern. Einstein outlined his objections to quantum physics. Afterward, the students asked questions, attempting to defend Bohr's views as they had been taught by Wheeler. Einstein handled them with patience, asking in return with a slight smile, "When a mouse observes, does that change the state of the universe?" One of the first-year graduate students in the room that day made note of Einstein's pithy challenge to the Copenhagen interpretation. A year later, Einstein was dead, and the student, Hugh Everett, was putting Einstein's words to good use in defense of his own new interpretation of quantum physics. Unlike Einstein, and like Bohm, Everett attempted to resolve the problems of quantum physics through the mathematics of quantum physics itself, rather than attempting to find an entirely new theory. But unlike Bohm, Everett's solution didn't involve pilot waves. Everett's answer to the questions that lurked at the foundations of quantum physics was wholly original, and far stranger than anything Bohm or Einstein had ever proposed. Hugh Everett III was born on November 11, 1930, into a family with Virginia roots that stretched back generations on his father's side. His paternal great-grandfather had fought for the Confederacy in the Civil War. Everett's father, Hugh Everett Jr., was a military engineer and logistics officer whose existence revolved around the Army. His mother, Catherine, was a free-spirited writer and pacifist. She and Hugh Jr. were a bad match temperamentally and philosophically, and they divorced, scandalous for the time, several years after Hugh III was born. Hugh grew up in Bethesda, Maryland, with his father and stepmother. His family dubbed him Pudge because of his somewhat stocky build. Everett hated the nickname, but it stuck with him for the rest of his life. With his nose usually buried in a science fiction book, Hugh showed early signs of academic talent, and a taste for paradoxes. At 12, he wrote a letter to Einstein, claiming to have solved the question of what would happen if an immovable object met an unstoppable force. The letter is lost, but Einstein replied, saying that while unstoppable forces and immovable objects weren't real, there seems to be a very stubborn boy who has forced his way victoriously through strange difficulties created by himself for this purpose. A year later, Everett won a scholarship to St. John's, a Catholic military prep academy in Washington, D.C. There, he excelled in nearly all of his classes, even the required religious instruction, despite the fact that his vocal atheism had already earned him a new nickname, the Heretic. Everett graduated with honors in 1948 and went on to study at Catholic University, also in D.C., where he studied chemical engineering and mathematics, quickly impressing his professors and classmates with his remarkable facility for math and logic. Unsurprisingly, for a talented student of logic, Everett's taste for paradoxes was still lively. His patience for his required religious instruction wearing thin, Everett challenged one of his devout professors at Catholic with a proof of the non-existence of God. The professor was purportedly sent into a state of serious religious doubt and despair, to Everett's dismay. Everett wasn't particularly interested in actually convincing anyone to fundamentally shift their worldview. He just wanted to have fun. And for Everett, fun entailed gaming out the logical consequence of a statement and winning the argument at hand. Sending someone into a tailspin of religious faith wasn't the goal at all. Everett resolved not to show his proof to anyone devout again, but it was a resolution he couldn't keep. He showed the proof to religious friends on and off again for the rest of his life, unable to keep from delighting in the absurd. Everett graduated from Catholic in 1953 and won a place in Princeton's physics PhD program. He had applied 6 weeks late, but it didn't matter, as the Princeton faculty were eager to meet such an extraordinarily talented student. Everett had scored in the 99th percentile on the brand new physics GRE, and he had stellar letters of recommendation. "This is a once-in-a-lifetime recommendation. Everett is by far the best student I have had at Princeton, Rutgers, or Catholic University. Everett has a better knowledge of mathematics than most of the graduate students at Catholic University, and probably no graduate student is his equal in native ability." The National Science Foundation, NSF, also brand new, was similarly impressed, and paid for Everett's graduate tuition and stipend. At Princeton, Everett became particularly close with three of his classmates, and they shared an apartment later on. "Everett was a lot of fun. He enjoyed needling people," recalled Hale Trotter, one of the three. "He was very competitive at whatever it was, if it was a poker game or it was ping pong," recalled another, Harvey Arnold. "Everett always wanted to go away the winner, and he would make you stay there until he succeeded." Charles Meisner, the final member of the trio, agreed, calling Everett a brilliant oddball whose favorite sport was one-upmanship. Though Meisner was hasty to point out that it was always friendly competition with Everett. Everett's Princeton friends were also impressed with his brilliance. "It surprised me after I got to know him that he was as brilliant as he was," recalled Arnold. "It didn't come across until you got close to him, and then you would recognize that this guy would be on top of the world. He was smart in a very broad way. I mean, to go from chemical engineering to mathematics to physics, and spending most of the time buried in a science fiction book? I mean, this is talent." In his early days at Princeton, Everett put that talent to work in a mathematically rigorous field befitting someone with his sense of competition, the mathematical theory of games. Everett's interest was practical as well as personal. Game theory was the language spoken by military strategists and operations researchers in the Pentagon, where Everett already had ambitions to work after earning his PhD. Princeton was among the best places in the world to study game theory at the time. Von Neumann, one of the founders of the field, was just down the street at the Institute for Advanced Study. And other game theory giants, like Oscar Morgenstern and Albert Tucker, were at the university itself. There was also a weekly game theory seminar,
with lectures from Princeton faculty and visiting luminaries, including John Nash. Everett attended the seminar regularly during his first year, and ultimately wrote and presented a short paper there that went on to be a classic in the field. When he wasn't occupied by his game theory habit, Everett's attention was increasingly captured by quantum physics. Most graduate courses on quantum physics in the United States at the time hardly discussed the puzzles at the heart of the subject. The course Everett took in his first year at Princeton was no exception. But reading both von Neumann's classic textbook and Bohm's newer one, Everett saw there was a problem lurking at the heart of the theory. Von Neumann's textbook made it clear that wave function collapse was separate from the Schrödinger equation, something extra added to make sense of the theory. But where did it come from? Bohm's book, with its valiant attempt to defend the Copenhagen interpretation, made it clear to Everett that the usual way of thinking about quantum physics couldn't answer that question. Bohm's pilot wave papers, meanwhile, provided a concrete alternative to the standard view. Working on that kind of research problem was disreputable, independently of the fact that Bohm himself was politically radioactive at the time. But Everett didn't particularly care about what was or wasn't reputable, and Einstein's disparaging attitude toward the Copenhagen interpretation made it easier to think about challenging it, as did the fact that several other experts on the foundations of quantum physics in Princeton at the time, like Wigner and von Neumann, didn't always see eye to eye with Bohr. Meanwhile, one of Everett's professors, John Wheeler, was obsessed with his own disreputable problem, general relativity. Despite the theory's universal acceptance, it wasn't seen as a reasonable field of research at the time. Wheeler was interested in the same problem Einstein was trying to solve, marrying general relativity to quantum physics in a single theory of quantum gravity, with the ultimate goal of describing the entire universe, including its origin, in the still more disreputable nascent field of quantum cosmology. He enlisted Charlie Meisner, Everett's friend, in this work. "Everyone talking with Wheeler at that time was likely to be encouraged to think about quantum gravity," recalled Meisner. Everett's interest in fundamental problems in quantum theory and his obvious talent made Wheeler a natural choice to be Everett's advisor. But the influence of Wheeler and his own taste for paradoxes weren't the only reason Everett was interested in the measurement problem. Everett's competitive nature was also at play, and his opponent this time was the assistant of Niels Bohr himself. In the fall of 1954, during Everett's second year at Princeton, Bohr came to the Princetitute for 4 months. He brought with him his assistant, O. Petersen, a Danish physicist only a few years older than Everett. Everett became friends with Petersen, and through him, he gained access to Bohr. That fall, Arnold saw Everett wandering the Princeton campus with Petersen and Bohr, lost in conversation. When Bohr lectured on campus, Everett and Meisner attended. They heard the old quantum master dismiss the idea of a quantum theory of measurement as wrong-headed. Around the same time, Everett passed his qualifying exams and started to think seriously about his PhD thesis. Everett wanted to do a short and fun thesis, but he needed a suitable subject. It occurred to him over drinks.
"One night at the graduate college after a slosh or two of sherry," Everett recalled, talking with Meisner years later, "you and O were starting to say some ridiculous things about the implications of quantum mechanics, and I was having a little fun, joshing you and telling you some of the outrageous implications of what you said, and, as we had a little more sherry and got a little more potted in the conversation, don't you remember, Charlie? You were there."
Meisner didn't remember, which Everett chalked up to too much sherry, and continued. Everett:
"Well, anyway, the whole business started with those discussions, and my impression is I went to Wheeler then later and said, 'Hey, how about this? This is the thing to do. This obvious inconsistency in the quantum theory,' or whatever I thought of it then."
Meisner:
"It is strange that he would be so interested in it. All in all, because it certainly went against the normal tenets of his great master Bohr."
Everett:
"Well, he still feels that way a little bit." At the time, Wheeler was preaching this idea that you ought to just look at the equations and obey the fundamentals of physics while you follow their conclusions and give them a serious hearing, according to Meisner. For his PhD thesis, Everett took Wheeler's advice. He looked at the outrageous implications of quantum physics and gave them a serious hearing. What he found was far more astonishing than anything in his beloved science fiction stories. We met the measurement problem back in Chapter 1. The problem, in a nutshell, is this. Quantum wave functions move along nice and smoothly, always obeying one simple and deterministic law, the Schrödinger equation, except when they don't. When a measurement happens, wave functions collapse. How and why wave function collapse happens, and what constitutes a measurement anyway, is the measurement problem, the central puzzle of quantum physics. Everett thought that measurement, as presented in von Neumann's textbook, was a magic process in which something quite drastic occurs, collapse of the wave function, while in all other time systems are assumed to obey perfectly natural continuous laws. Measurement shouldn't be fundamentally different from other physical processes. And even worse, according to Everett, von Neumann's approach doesn't even tell you what measurements are. If a measurement only happens when someone looks at a system, who, in particular, has to look? Everett argued that this line of reasoning leads inevitably to solipsism, the idea that you are the only being in the universe and everyone else is somehow illusory or secondary, existing in states of indeterminate reality until you, the high arbiter of wave function collapse, deign to observe them. In his thesis, Everett admitted that this is an internally consistent view, but that one must feel uneasy when, for example, writing textbooks on quantum mechanics, describing wave function collapse for the consumption of other persons to whom it does not apply. Bohr's idea that the quantum world of the small obeyed entirely different rules from those that governed the classical world of the large offered a possible way out of this dilemma. But at the cost of a unified picture of the world free of contradiction, a price Everett was, justifiably, unwilling to pay. The Copenhagen interpretation is hopelessly incomplete because of its a priori reliance on classical physics, excluding in principle any deduction of classical physics from quantum theory or any adequate investigation of the measuring process, Everett complained, as well as a philosophic monstrosity with a reality concept for the macroscopic world and denial of the same for the microcosm. Writing to Peterson, Everett stated his intentions quite clearly. The time has come to treat quantum physics in its own right as a fundamental theory without any dependence on classical physics and to derive classical physics from it. Like Bohm before him, Everett wanted to take quantum physics seriously as a theory of the entire world. Rejecting both von Neumann and Bohr, Everett came up with his own solution to the measurement problem. Rather than explaining wave function collapse, Everett stated that wave functions never collapse at all. This in itself was not new. Bohm said the same thing. But Bohm had also added particles with definite positions into the theory, which accounted for the outcomes of measurements. Everett didn't add particles. He didn't think he needed them. Instead, he insisted that a single universal wave function was all there was, a massive mathematical object describing the quantum states of all objects in the entire universe. This universal wave function, according to Everett, obeyed the Schrödinger equation at all times, never collapsing, but splitting instead. Each experiment, each quantum event, spun off new branches of the universal wave function, creating a multitude of universes in which that one event had every possible outcome. Everett's shocking idea came to be known as the many worlds interpretation of quantum physics. The many worlds interpretation sounds absurd at first blush, and probably at second blush too. We live in one world, not a multitude of them. If every quantum event, and in a fully quantum world, that's every event of any kind, leads the universe to split, where are these other universes? How could there possibly be so many of them without any indication that they're there? And for that matter, how can any single event, one photon going through one double-slit apparatus, for example, cause the entire universe to split? To understand how the many worlds interpretation accounts for these problems, let's take a second look at a simple quantum experiment, even simpler than the double slit, Schrödinger's cat. Way back in the introduction, we met Schrödinger's thought experiment, which has given the ASPCA nightmares for over 80 years. Put a cat in a box, along with a vial of poison and a lump of weakly radioactive metal. Set up a Geiger counter, radiation detector, and a hammer so that the hammer will smash the vial if the detector detects any radiation. Then, leave the cat in the box long enough that there's a 50-50 chance that the metal has emitted radiation. Now what? Is the cat dead or alive? According to the Copenhagen interpretation, the question is meaningless. You can't ask what happened before you opened the box because it's unobservable. According to Bohm and the pilot wave interpretation, the question is quite meaningful. We just don't know the answer to it. The cat is either dead or alive, and we'll find out which when we open the box. But what does the mathematics say? What does Schrödinger's equation say about Schrödinger's cat? Well, the wave function of the lump of metal is half radiation was emitted, and half no radiation was emitted. That interacts with the wave function of the detector, which means they get entangled. So now instead of two wave functions, one for the lump of metal and one for the detector, you have one for the both of them. And now that's in a weird state. Half radiation was emitted and the detector detected it, and half no radiation was emitted and the detector didn't see anything. As the quantum Rube Goldberg machine continues on its merry way, wave functions keep getting entangled. The wave function of the hammer entangles with the wave function of the detector and metal. The wave function of the vial entangles with the wave function of the hammer and detector and metal, and so on. The wave function of the vial entangles with the wave function of the hammer and detector and metal, and so on, eventually including the cat itself. The whole system, cat, box, metal, poison, and all, ultimately ends up sharing a single wave function. And that wave function, again, has two equal parts. One part in which radiation was emitted and the cat is dead, and another in which no radiation was emitted and the cat is alive. So far, so good. Now what happens when you open the box? The usual answer, the answer of the Copenhagen interpretation and the answer given by von Neumann's famous textbook, is that a measurement causes the wave function to collapse. But what if it doesn't? What if we treat you the same way we treated everything in the box? Well, in that case, when you look in the box, you're interacting with it, which means you get entangled with the shared wave function of the box and everything in it. So now we have an even bigger wave function, still with two parts, one where you see a dead cat and a smashed vial of poison, and one where you see a happy cat and an intact vial. Which part of the wave function is real? Everett, remembering Wheeler's advice to take the consequences of physical laws seriously, answered that both are real. There's no way to pick one as more real than the other. The Schrödinger equation treats them equally. So when you perform this experiment, Everett said, both outcomes occur, and you split in two. Of course, it doesn't seem like we split in two when we perform experiments, or any time at all, for that matter. But Everett had an answer ready for this as well. If I ask the you that sees the living cat how many cats you see, you'll answer, just one. And if I ask the same question of the you in the other branch of the wave function, the one with the dead cat, the answer will be the same, though your tone of voice will probably be quite different.
The same thing happens, Everett pointed out, if I ask each copy of you how many selves you see. There is only one copy of you in each branch of the wave function, and even if you repeat the experiment, this will still be true. There will be more branches, but each branch will still only have one copy of you. And the Schrödinger equation dictates that each branch will carry on independently of the others, with hardly any interaction between branches. Strange enough, but we're not done. As you interact with the things in your environment, they get entangled with you, and then other things get entangled with them, and so on. Eventually, we have a single, complicated, and messy wave function for the entire universe, the universal wave function. And as more events happen, that universal wave function splits into more and more non-interacting parts, each merrily marching along to the deterministic beat of the Schrödinger equation. These are the many worlds of Everett's interpretation. They may seem absurd on the face of it. There is, after all, only one world that we experience. But if that's your objection, Everett's reply is that you're hardly alone. To each person in each branch of the universal wave function, their world appears to be the only world, just as there appeared to be only one cat in the box and one you looking at it. This is a hallmark of the many worlds interpretation, the appearance of a single world, despite the true existence of many. When Everett finished a draft of his thesis in January 1956, Wheeler was the first to see it. Wheeler had enormous respect for Everett's abilities. Writing to the NSF, Wheeler said that Everett originated an apparent paradox in the interpretation of the measurement problem in quantum theory. In discussions of this paradox with graduate students and staff members here at Princeton and with Niels Bohr, Everett brought to light new features of the problem that make it in and of itself an appropriate subject for an outstanding thesis when further developed. Everett really is an original man. But Wheeler was caught between several competing interests. He wanted to support a brilliant student's work, and he also wanted to find a way forward with quantum cosmology. Supporting Everett's idea of a universal wave function would further both of those interests. But Wheeler also wanted to remain loyal to his mentor and friend, Bohr. Indeed, Wheeler idolized Bohr, writing that, "Nothing has done more to convince me that there once existed friends of mankind with the human wisdom of Confucius and Buddha, Jesus and Pericles, Erasmus and Lincoln, than walks and talks under the beech trees of Klampenborg Forest with Niels Bohr." Wheeler was a political animal. He knew how to work with others and how to keep others happy with his ideas in exactly the way that Einstein could not. He knew that supporting Everett at the cost of his relationship with Bohr was a bad career move. "John Wheeler got along with everybody," recalled Meisner. But in Hughes' case, Wheeler had a very difficult time applying his usual tactics because he couldn't just encourage Hugh to follow his ideas and present them as powerfully as possible, since they ran contrary to Bohr's ideas. But Wheeler was also unwilling to give up Everett's theory of a universal wave function. He saw it as a possible path forward for quantum gravity, an opportunity too good to pass up. This left Wheeler with only one option. He would attempt to secure Bohr's own blessing for Everett's work before endorsing it himself. In mid-1956, Wheeler had his chance. He was invited to a visiting post at Leiden University in the Netherlands for several months. Once Wheeler had settled in there, he sent Everett's thesis draft, appropriately titled Wave Mechanics Without Probability, to Bohr, along with an introductory note. Tripping over himself to excuse any possible perception of Everett as contradicting Bohr, Wheeler wrote that the title itself, like so many of the ideas in it, need further analysis and rephrasing. Wheeler himself soon followed in person and discussed Everett's thesis with Bohr, Peterson, and others in Copenhagen for several days. Writing to Everett after his Copenhagen visit, Wheeler at first sounded hopeful and clear-eyed about the work yet to be done. "Bohr and Peterson and I had three long and strong discussions about it. Stating conclusions briefly,
Your beautiful wave function formalism, of course, remains unshaken. But all of us feel that the real issue is the words that are to be attached to the quantities of the formalism. Wheeler implored his student to come to Copenhagen himself and resolve these problems, and offered to pay half of Everett's steamship fare to make it happen.